Davy Crockett told him back east, "You may all go to hell, and I will go to Texas." Here's a guy that thinks Davy got it right. It's Pratt on Texas with Robert Pratt.
Well, there was the sound. You hear how excited people are. If you know anything about technology and what's happening and the precipice of change upon which humanity sits, led mostly by free market capitalism and risk takers and innovators, you understand why these people are cheering so loud. We welcome Bob Zimmerman. He keeps the website BehindTheBlack.com, one of my favorites. I read it every single evening. SpaceX lands the first stage again. Bob, tell us about it.
Well, I have to tell you, even as I was listening to that again, I was cheering. They did it. They did it. I went to watch this knowing the odds were really slim that they'd succeed. They, even in the audio that you just played, they said this is really hard because it's coming from a much higher distance and much greater speeds. They're developing this technology so they can reuse the first stage, but they've said all along that in certain situations it's going to be very difficult to get that stage back safely, and the more important thing is to get their customers' payload into the right orbit. And that was their goal on this mission, but they were going to try anyway to land it. That they succeeded tells you very clearly, tells us all, that their technology for doing this is becoming increasingly robust, which means they're going to be able to do it much more routinely in the future. We don't know yet if this particular first stage is going to be functional because of the speeds and heats it was in, it experienced as it came down. It could have been, you know, it might not be reusable. It might be need too much refurbishment. But that they now have technology that allows them to control a first stage, even with limited fuel, and come down and safely land on a barge in the dark, out in the middle of the ocean. Tiny
well,
barge
Bob,
relative to everything.
Bob,
it's just incredible.
Did you see that it hit the center of the... This time it actually, in the dark, in the hardest one, it hit the center of the circle.
There's something I pointed out on Behind the Black, and you mentioned it as well. The crowd screaming, cheering, everyone's very excited. And every single time that SpaceX has successfully landed its first stage, this is now the third time they've done it, the crowd breaks out into a chant of USA, USA.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why they do it, and they might not even be aware of it. I call it the forgotten word. There's a reason why it happened here. It's not happening anywhere else in the world. It's why, even though we have not done the right things in the last 50 years, but they were cheering because this is the country that was founded on a concept of freedom. And only in a concept of freedom could you have a company try to do such a thing. Because for the last half century, I've been told repeatedly by rocket engineers and managers and NASA people that this can't be done, it's not practical to do, it is foolish to waste the effort or the time, and they have all been proven completely wrong because one man, Elon Musk, had the courage to follow his dream and make a demand of his engineers who were willing to try, and because of freedom, they were able to succeed.
Oh,
and it's very important we remember that.
And at much lower cost than the government programs do anything, even when they succeed or fail. Look, we've got to give credit here as well. Suborbital, right out here in Texas near Van Horn, between Odessa and El Paso. You've got the other one, Bezos outfit, the Blue Origin, and their very secretive, very different way of dealing with that operation. They have done the suborbital. They've landed it twice. It's brilliant. SpaceX, a little bit different. Of course, they test their rockets in McGregor. The interesting thing is people were saying, well, even if you land it, you won't be able to reuse this. But what's happening is that SpaceX has already recovered that last stage that did actually launch something into space, and they're testing it, going through it, and they now have science available to them and data available to them that no one else in history has ever had, and I damn well bet they can make the engineering changes to make these units robust enough to justify that new pricing sheet that they released. That tell everybody what that pricing sheet does.
Well, I just want to insert that they plan to use that second recovered first stage, the one, the first one to land on a barge. They are planning right now to reuse it in a June launch. That's what they've said. Now, they might not, but that's their plan, in a June launch. And they already have one satellite commercial company, SES, from Luxembourg, who has said they want to buy that first stage to launch a satellite because they know they'll get a better price.
I'll tell you what, let's stop. Let's pause it right there. Take our break. We'll come back. We're visiting with Bob Zimmerman. You can see more of Bob's work at BehindTheBlack.com. He wrote one of my favorite, all-time favorite nonfiction books, and actually many more. I enjoyed his book, The Official History of Hubble, as well. We'll pick this up on the other side of the break right here, my friends, on the Proudhon, Texas Radio Network. We're visiting with science writer Bob Zimmerman. His website is BehindTheBlack.com. We were talking about this incredible achievement that SpaceX has made over the past few months with this morning's launch, actually returning a first-stage rocket. And you heard Bob Zimmerman talk about how people always said, oh, this can't be done. It's not even worth trying. They landed it back on a barge out in the ocean for reuse and in a launch where it was very, very much expected. Even their people said it probably wouldn't make it, but just because the physics of this particular launch. But it did make it. And we were talking about this, and I was leading to the point of, why does this matter to all of us? Why does this matter? What's with this price list that SpaceX has come out with? What is it with this private sector space as opposed to the old Soviet-style, yes, even here, government model of space exploration? Talk about that, Bob Zimmerman.
Well, I'll tell you, you mentioned it already with when you said Blue Origin in Texas and SpaceX building a spaceport in near Brownsville, and them doing their testing in McGregor, Texas. Just to very quickly get to it, you know, they never have put the money in a capsule and launched it into space. It all gets done here down on Earth. It gets spent here on Earth. And when you have a competitive, aggressive, profitable aerospace industry, it generates wealth for everybody on Earth. And that's what's beginning to happen with SpaceX. And their price list that they released, they changed their price list that they post on their webpage. I mean, this is unlike any other rocket company in the world. They have a price list. You know exactly what it's going to cost to launch a Falcon 9, and they've now announced what it costs to launch with a Falcon Heavy, and the core prices how much weight you can get up depends on where you want to go, and they include in where you want to go going to Mars. They can use either one of those rockets to send the payload to Mars, and they tell you how much weight you can get to Mars, and with the Falcon Heavy, which has not launched yet, but I expect to have its first test launch before the end of this year now, they can get 50-plus tons into orbit, which gives you enough capability to get a really substantial payload to Mars. Any science mission we've ever flown unmanned could get to Mars very easily with that payload capability. It's half the strength of a Saturn V. Will make it the most powerful rocket built since the Saturn V. And now we get to the cost, Robert. The cost is pennies. While NASA's been trying to build its space launch system and Orion capsule, and they're going to spend about $45 billion in about 15
but
years.
But congressmen are designing it.
Yeah. $45 billion. It's going to take 15 years to get the first launch, and that won't pay for any further launches. $45 billion to do two launches, so figure about $20 billion a launch. You can buy a Falcon Heavy launch to go to Mars for under $100 million. That's $90 million is the price they put, which, by the way, is less than what everybody else in the world charges for a standard geosynchronous launch, which is less than half the payload, less than half of that, and with much less capability. And these prices, by the way, are before they begin to recover the first stages of both rockets and can give a discount because they're reusing the first stages. Now, how does this change things? It brings in customer base. More people can afford to launch payloads into space. They can start businesses. They can therefore innovate and create profit. More people can buy their product, which means more people can afford to be customers of space. It's a never-ending positive
cycle.
Exactly.
And people often forget. They tend to think of, well, a telecommunications satellite or something that beams me television. No, this is internet. This is more things than you can imagine. Geospatial stuff. I mean, our farmers around here mostly have satellite drivers on their tractors now. Everybody's using, even in row crop work, the tractors can be driven much more precisely, save money. We're reducing irrigation costs by using these systems that look from these. And this is where we're getting. It's just all these little parts of the economy you don't think of. And when you drastically, and that's what we're talking about through private sector space, dramatically reduce the cost to get things in orbit. And folks, that's what's happening. Dramatic reduction in cost. There are things we could never have dreamed of that will be invented, that will be up there, and they will be inexpensive as paying for your local internet or something like that. And that's exciting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a good example could be this, just one off the top of my head, which is not actually, it's already been dreamed of, but no one's done it, which is somehow obtaining solar power, energy from space. Well, it's been talked about for decades, but the cost of getting into orbit makes any engineering concept there impractical. It's not cost-effective. It doesn't compete with the energy sources on Earth. Well, you bring the cost of launch down, suddenly those possibilities become more probable. I mean, for example, launch companies have contracts right now, including SpaceX, but including Virgin Galactic, including others, small companies, to put a constellation of 900 satellites in orbit to provide worldwide internet service.
Right.
The company that's trying to do that, they're not really aiming at the American market because we don't need it.
But a large
percentage of the world don't have the access that we do, and this is a really cheap way to provide them internet access. They'll buy the product.
We're visiting with science writer Bob Zimmerman. His website's behindtheblack.com. I read it every day. Bob, what are the Europeans, what is it, Aryan Space? What are the Europeans and the Russians up to as far as the launch industry?
All right. Well, the launch industry, until SpaceX came along, basically had four institutions competing for business, and Ariane Space had 50% of the commercial market. They launch a rocket called the Ariane 5. It puts up two satellites with each launch. Costs about $100 million per satellite. That's what they've been charging for decades, $100 million. You know, that's slightly more than what the Falcon 9 will charge. The Russians have been charging around $90 million for their Proton rocket for decades. And then there was Orbital Sciences, or now Orbital ATK, which had a variety of smaller launch rockets for smaller payloads. And then you have ULA, the United Launch Alliance, which is a partnership of Lockheed Martin and Boeing. Their mainstay rocket really is the Atlas V. The Delta IV family of rockets that Lockheed has is too expensive generally to compete and is being phased out.
By the way, they have deep Texas ties as well. They build a good portion of the rocket assembly. Something about that is done in Harlingen, just north of Brownsville in the Rio Grande Valley. Big plant there.
They have a problem, though, because the Atlas V is very expensive. They've been charging somewhere between $125 to maybe $250 million.
Why not? They got the Air Force contracts by default.
Right.
They had a monopoly.
That it's $225 million per launch for the Air Force. And they had a monopoly for a long time until SpaceX came along. SpaceX came along with its Falcon 9 saying it would charge $60 million a launch, which is a third less than the Russians. And the Russians admitted, we can't lower to that price. Russians, with their lower labor costs, still could not match that price. And it all really comes down to what SpaceX first started. They said, we're going to build everything ourselves because this is not really complicated anymore. It's robust technology. And we're going to keep it simple. They built one engine. They designed one engine, and they just keep reusing it in all the stages. And so therefore, they don't have to design multiple engines. They keep it fairly simple. And because of that, the cost is low. And therefore, they can charge less, and they are charging less. And, you know, you figure most companies charge 100% over their costs. That'll cover really, make sure you have your profits when things go wrong. Well, if that's the case, then that means it costs them about $30 million to build a Falcon 9 rocket.
It's amazing.
Now,
and
I believe
let's talk about what's
and
that.
I also believe they're going to drop their price another 30% to $40 million for a launch, and when they reuse the first stage, which means it's probably going to cost them what, about $20 million to do a launch, and that's only the beginning. Sooner or later, they're going to find ways to reuse that first that second stage. And they're going to find ways to do it even cheaper than they're doing now because they're going to keep pushing.
What about Ariane Space and where are they? Their rockets? Aren't they having a big to-do about getting out from under the government bureaucracy of that outfit? What's going on there?
Oh, well, SpaceX has always basically been on top of the government bureaucracy. They basically push NASA and FAA around because they've always been out front, and therefore the government's been chasing them. And so, for example, FAA is the one that gives launch licenses out, and they like to hold control of that and make everyone wimp around and do what they say. And the Air Force controls the range at Kennedy and at Vandenberg, and so you got to make them happy. And so what does SpaceX do when they're going to launch it, when they're going to do a launch? They basically say, we're going to do a launch, give us the permit, we're going to do a launch, and they make it, announce it publicly. The politicians and the bureaucrats, they can't say no to those permits because it'll be politically bad. And then when it comes to the Air Force and the range control at Kennedy and Vandenberg, well, SpaceX said, you know what, let's build our own commercial spaceport.
Right.
We'll do it at Brownsville, we'll be able to control the range ourselves, simplify the whole operation. So they stay out ahead. That's how they make it work.
Yeah, and I didn't get my question in clearly, but that was excellent, and I'm glad we talked about that. What about the Europeans, though, Arian? Don't they have this problem that thing's a consortium of governments, and it's heavily bureaucratic, and aren't they trying to do something with Airbus or somebody to make it a private company where they have less bureaucracy? What's happening? And do they build their own rocket, or are they using Russian parts like some of these American people and everybody else?
Well, all right, Ariane Space previously was a company that was under the control of the European Space Agency, and their goal was to distribute the subcontractual work to build the Ariane 5 to as many countries in the European Space Agency as possible.
Like NASA does to
spread
States.
It around.
Yeah, it's like
now,
NASA.
What has happened is the lead contractor for building Ariane 6, the next rocket, that's Airbus and Safran. These are two different major contractors. They formed a joint venture, and they basically told the European Space Agency, we'll build you your new rocket, but we have to own it, and we have to control it. And so European Space Agency, desperate to get a new rocket that's competitive, made a deal. They basically gave controlling stock over to Airbus, Safran. Ariane Space is basically going to be out of the picture, and this allows them now to come up with a design that needs fewer subcontractors, is more efficiently run, and therefore will cost less. And so that's what's going on there. So the next rocket is going to be privately controlled and owned.
All right. And then in Russia, you have the re-Stalinization, the Putinization of Russia, and we see exactly what's happening from moving into this competitive world. The state's taken over everything, combined everything, and they've got problems, don't they?
Well, it seems that the culture in Russia has to be top-down Soviet style. They just can't do it any other way. They try private enterprise and competitive companies, but instead they set it up almost like the mob in the Prohibition area. They divided up their territories and would not allow any new companies in. And so what you don't get any competition, you get a lot of corruption. And so Putin has taken over everything, and he's trying to straighten things out and get the corruption out. Of course, there's lots of corruption there. There's no way around it because it's top-down, power-driven. Whether that's going to produce an efficient industry, it probably will make it more efficient with less corruption. Will it make it more innovative? Absolutely not. They're going to have trouble competing with everybody else.
Joining the late William F. Buckley, standing athwart history and yelling, stop! It's Robert Pratt with Pratt on Texas.
Bob Zimmerman, we've talked about the Russians and Ariane Space. We lined out basically the traditional rocket companies in this country that were getting all the business, mainly ULA, the defense contractors teamed up getting these, having a monopoly on Air Force and government business. And now SpaceX coming in like the private sector does and really just beginning to change everything. But then you've got all of these other companies. Midland International Airport's now a spaceport, and there's some kind of supposed company based there that's designing something. You've got Blue Origin doing their work in Van Horn. and really, you got just over, not far from where we sit as well, north of Van Horn and west of me, that taxpayer boondoggle, taxpayer-built spaceport for the boondoggle that's Virgin Galactic. And then there are other companies. Kind of give us a review of where all these stand.
All right, well, let me mention the one in Midland. That's X-Corps. They're building a suborbital plane they call the Lynx. They are a company I've always been somewhat skeptical of. I wish them well. They recently received an infusion of new capital, so possibly they'll get that thing off the ground finally, but they are already about 8 years behind schedule. Right. I rank them about equal to Virgin Galactic in my confidence in their success. There are other companies that are less well known that are going to start to appear on the radar in the next year. One of them is called Rocket Lab. They have a small rocket they call Electron, which is aimed at launching small payloads, such as that earlier I mentioned to you that that constellation of 900 right. satellites to provide worldwide internet capability. Those are small satellites. They don't need a big rocket to get up in space. They need a small rocket, and Electron is aimed at that market. It'll be very cheap to launch. They, like SpaceX, only building one engine. They call it the Rutherford, and they've already done their test, ground testing on it for its second stage use. They're going to put it in the first stage as well. They hope to actually do their first test flights of that rocket sometime later this year, and they're going to be launching, by the way, out of New Zealand. So they're an interesting company, and they are definitely out there and real. You've got Virgin Galactic, by the way, Spaceship Two, who knows if that'll ever fly, but they have shifted gears, and they're building something called Launcher One, which is designed to the idea of, once again, getting these small satellites into orbit, and they have a launch contract with that company to put up about 30 of those satellites in that constellation. You got other companies as well. They're scattered about, and many of them are not going to succeed. We have to be aware that this is a tough business. In competition, companies fail. Some will succeed, some will fail, but the competition will weed out the less good ideas.
But Bob, it's like the early automobile business. There were so many brands, and some of them merged and became bigger companies. Others went away. Some hung on for a long time because, you know, SpaceX, they come in, they do very well, they capture certain markets, but then somebody uses what they've learned from them or inspired from them, and they find a new market. And as we put more in space, there's going to be new markets we haven't even considered. And like these companies you mentioned, there'll be others that pop up with innovative designs. Maybe they're the leftovers of failed companies. We don't know. But I think we're going to see all kinds of companies over the next two decades that many we've never heard of.
Yeah, and for example, SpaceX might be in the lead right now, but competition, someone's going to come along to try to beat their game. There's another company, Stratolaunch. Actually, it's Vulcan Aerospace. They're building their mothership. It's the biggest airplane ever built. It's going to be basically assembled from two 747s. They'll put under its belly a really big rocket to put up geosynchronous satellites. And their idea is, once again, to make the first stage reusable as a plane. They're building. I don't know if they're going to succeed. I hope they do, but again, it's new ideas that make this go.
Let's hope it's not a new spruce goose. But it could end up. It's big enough. It could end up being one of those tourist hotels if it fails. but it's a good idea, and it's an idea people have long had to just get up above gravity further, so you don't have to. It's just so hard to get off the Earth's gravity, off the ground.
Well, you know, the key here is just trying new ideas. Let failure happen. Don't worry about it. You got to give it a try. Once again, following freedom. Freedom involves risk. It means you accept the risk, you live with the risk, and you accomplish great things in the doing. Some don't succeed. That's just the cost of freedom.
And I think
the cost is minor when you get down to what you get in the end.
And this is why the government programs don't work very well. I mean, when you were in a competitive environment like the space race with the Russians, you took risks. But normally, politics is always very risk averse. Every person from the bureaucrats not wanting to lose their jobs, all the good people as well as the bad, to the politicians who have to vote for it. You know, people get very angry when, it blew up on the launch pad and that was $2 billion or $5 billion. It doesn't lend itself to risk-taking, whereas private sector space does, and I think we're going to see exponential increases in innovation.
There's another aspect to this, too. too, that, you know, when you have competition, you have many different ideas going. You get redundancy, mm-hmm. flexibility, and innovation, right? Many different competing companies. What the space program does is it comes up with one idea, and then NASA dedicates the next decade to that one idea. If it doesn't work, you've lost a decade. They have to start over with another single idea. And when you do that serial approach to things, you never can get much done because you're not really competing and coming up with multiple ideas. You have no redundancy. You have no flexibility. And that's been the proven track record of NASA since the shuttle. We had the shuttle, the decades, no innovation. Then you follow that up with the orbital space plane, no innovation. You add the X-33. As each one of those failed, they had to start over. Then you had Constellation. It got rejected by Obama, so you had to start over, and now you got SLS. If the next president isn't a Democrat, or even if it is, the next president might decide, I don't like SLS, dump it, we're going to do a new program, you know, and it'll be just the same waste of money. Better to have many competing companies coming up with their own ideas, and you buy that off the market. You buy the product off the market.
Yeah, I think we all win when we move in the direction where NASA does things like interplanetary research, and they simply buy the resources off the private market, and when you have a robust market, they can then specify in their bid, okay, we're going to do something a little unique here. People will bid on it, which is kind of how it works now, but you're going to have a much more healthy atmosphere, and frankly, they'll be able to do more of the research that they've done such a good job with when they have the private market and so many options instead of trying to manage all of this stuff and create it through a bureaucratic program that, as we learned recently, congressmen sitting on committees actually try to design the rockets and tell them what to do and not to do as if they have a clue. We'll be back in a moment, my friends. We're going to talk politics with Bob Zimmerman. Now, my friends, I've told you many times before, we've had him on the show to talk about it, but those of you who are readers and those of you who aren't because, well, you just don't do it very often, I'll tell you something you'll love, period. And it's Genesis, the story of Apollo 8. The ebook version is available. It is one of the finest nonfiction. I don't know why, but for whatever reason, this is the most interesting thing on space, the Apollo program, anything like that I've ever read more than the movies and all the other big stuff, Apollo 13. This Apollo 8 book, Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, is just fantastic. And you can click on the link and get the ebook version of it at behindtheblack.com. And by the way, after you read that, go get the official history of Hubble by Robert Zimmerman as well. You're going to enjoy it. And I just can't say enough how much the story of Apollo 8, Genesis, that book is to me. I thought it was just so much better than most of the other nonfiction books. And frankly, I do nonfiction all damn day long, and I'm always tired. I want to read a spy thriller or something. Well, this book kept me that interested, and I really do recommend it to you. Bob Zimmerman, before we get to the the political scene that you talk about a lot on behindtheblack.com, which I comment on occasionally there, you had a little fun with the story that hit the national news a few days after it was in the state news, and I covered it big, and I had a lot of fun with it, too. And it's this incredibly ridiculous story out of one of the school districts in the Harris County area, in Houston County, where this girl gets in trouble. They call cops to investigate her. They go to multiple levels. They even trace it down to a convenience store and then to a bank. Nobody, everybody too stupid, too ignorant, and then too lazy to simply do. I get it. You don't know. All right, fine. You could have done a Google search. They thought she was guilty of passing counterfeit money because she gave a $2 bill, which is in circulation right now, you morons, a $2 bill at lunch. Is this not a sign of who is it out there that always says a sign of the coming apocalypse? That's got to be one of them.
Well, one of my readers on Behind the Black instantly commented, you know, it took 2 seconds of a Google search and you come up with the Treasury Department website listing all denominations, including $2 bills and what it looks like. This was a failure of school officials who didn't know this and didn't have the sense to check it out. It was
a failure of
the police. Multiple levels of police who proceeded, you know, thinking it's counterfeit, trying to find out the source, and they ended up at a bank, which the bank told them, you know, guys, this is real. And they didn't have the they didn't have the decency to even apologize to the girl about this or to her
parents. And her, and I think it's her grandmother or mother. I think her grandmother she lives with that sent her to school with the $2 bill. Her grandmother said, they didn't even apologize. You know, that's all the hell they put this girl through. And you know, that's what I did when I got the story to verify. Now, I knew $2 bills were real because it's not uncommon, Bob, that a lot of people out there think they're not. I once went to the bank and ordered a bunch of them up and used to give them out just for that purpose.
Right.
Because people have misused the phrase funny as a $3 bill. They started saying it funny as a $2 bill. And it, the whole thing is silly, but, you know, I get it. The lunch lady may not have known. But at what point do you just go to the office and somebody look this up before you've called multiple levels of police, the school police and the local department, and they go to a store and they, I mean, is this not just a sign of how absolutely ignorant even some of the credentialed classes are?
There is, I have a phrase that I use in Behind the Black, the coming dark age.
Yeah,
and there is a great deal of incredible ignorance out there. And a lot of it, sadly enough, is willful ignorance, which is worse.
Right.
Which is a case of
that's
refusing.
What I call stupidity on this show. When you,
I'm having a very long debate right now on Behind the Black with another science writer of real note about climate change. And I can't get this guy to even look at any of the sources I send him.
No.
It's real. It's happening. Well, why don't you look at some of No, it's real. It's happening. And it's willful blindness. And this is happening throughout a society. It's really a bad sign.
We call it stupidity here. I say, you know, when you choose to be ignorant, it's not ignorance anymore. It's stupidity because you're choosing to be ignorant. And the climate thing's a good example of it. You've got information. Well, we can get bogged down in that, but you're exactly right. And this is a serious problem. I've long talked about, I spoke to some young people yesterday at a school. I said, you know, you ought to go back and look at the Enlightenment. What's happened is science, not actual science, but the term science and the social club around it has become the new dogma. They're the new dogmatists. Everything is flipped upside down. You've got all the religions questioning everything now, including their exact literal teachings and going against it. Everything's flipped upside down, and the science is the dogma. And you had a really good piece out there, Al Gore's movie, A Review of an Inconvenient Truth a decade later, and it's just like all of these other ones. Nothing, none of these predictions are right.
The heart of, and this is when it comes to climate change, I don't argue whether it's happening or not. I will just want to point
out,
always
changed.
And I do this, is the uncertainties. There are large uncertainties. There are a lot we just do not know. And to be certain about any of it is a really big mistake. And the problem, as you say, the dogmas, is that there is now a very strong political class in the science community, unfortunately, and in the political class that is trying to force solutions down our throats based upon what is clearly uncertain science. And from a scientific perspective, uncertainty is the rule. You're never certain about anything. You need a lot of data before you even get close to being confident about a result. And when it comes to the climate, which is incredibly complex, and no model has yet successfully predicted what's going to happen, and
not
they can predict the weather more than 5 days in advance without some error, it's a real mistake to say you have certainty here. And unfortunately, the willful blindness is a refusal to look at the uncertainties because we know, and that's all there is to it. We know, and you're going to obey what we tell you because we know. Well, I'm sorry, buddy, but you didn't know a $2 bill was currency. Why should I believe you about the climate?
One of the interesting points about that is that the climate, I always point this out to them, the climate has always been changing and at greatly varying degrees. So what's all the panic about? I mean, you know, all right, so maybe man's contributing to it, but there are opposite forces. We've seen that nature reacts to things. We know this is a political issue. This is to drive energy away, to move us back to this weird agrarian model and to keep people poor. And it's extremely, it is amazing to me that people think they give credibility to the lettered classes who say all this without realizing, once again, chosen ignorance. And sometimes it's maybe not everybody's fault because there are people in the media and others complicit with these people. They don't communicate the information. But none of the models have proven. None. And what that means, for those of you that don't understand science, is if none of the models have proven out, then the theory is false. The theory's wrong. That's right, exactly. You're visiting with Bob Zimmerman, our last segment together. Time flies when you're having fun. Bob, I love this headline out today. You and I have been on the same page pretty much almost some of the things you've written I've read on the air from BehindTheBlack.com. Just pretty much on the same page on the Trump and Obama thing all together. And the audience is familiar with what I think, so we don't have to bring them up to speed. But let's talk about Obama, Trump and Cruz. Let's talk about Obama for a moment. How about the headlines today? Obama skewers Trump as unvetted. I mean, here is the most unvetted candidate we ever had in history with no record. Trump, at least for all of his not, well, you know what I'm saying, but he's been in the public eye for decades. Nobody had heard of this Obama guy.
You know, I sometimes am speechless. The vetting that comes that exists for Obama has to do with the actual results of his policy after 7+ years.
Yeah.
And when he took power, the Iraq situation was settled down. He, in fact, declared victory and pulled our troops out. The Middle East was somewhat settled. The Middle East is on fire. You have terrorism worldwide spreading and increasing. He passed Obamacare, which has completely choked out the economy of the country nationwide. We've had 8 years of, and more than 8 years. It goes back before Obama's administration. I'm not partisan about this, but we've had really a terrible economy. There's been no effort to really, everything he has done has helped squeeze out the life in this part. In the economy. So for him to complain about, I mean, I have problems with Trump, but for him to complain about lack of vetting is
laughable.
A joke, because he's a disaster.
And he was one of the least vetted candidates in history. The mainstreamers wouldn't tell us even the stuff that was available, and he had almost no record.
Yes.
Now, you had a piece up yesterday in Cinco de Mayo. Trump's new finance chief donates two times more to Democrats than Republicans. Yes. This is just one in a long line of similar stories, isn't it?
Well, Trump's long track record is he's a New Yorker. I'm a New Yorker, but he's a New Yorker who has essentially had most of his links with the liberal Democratic Party, because he's in New York. I mean, you can't get away from it if you're in New York City. So his track record is that. Has he had a conversion to become a conservative? Maybe, but his track record doesn't encourage me to believe that. I hope that's the case. We're going to have to wait and see. But when I see that he appoints somebody as his finance chair who has donated more to Democrats than Republicans and has many links with very high-powered liberal, very left-wing people, it makes me very suspicious. That's evidence that Trump is not going to be a reliable Republican. Right now, I'm kind of jokingly calling the November election the November Democratic primary.
Oh, of course. That's what I feel. That's exactly how I feel. People say, well, you got to support your party. Look, I'm a former party chairman. You got to understand, this has been my life. But I believe in republicanism, you know, the diffusion of power amongst as many people and institutions as possible. And he doesn't. He's got strongmanism. And I see it as, well, wait a minute. I probably will back him. Don't get me wrong. I'd never vote for the Democrat, and I wouldn't go third party. But at the same time, it's funny to say you got to back the party's nominee when the party's nominee appears to be a Democrat. What's kind of the point in all of that?
But I was really hoping that this election we would finally have a real choice. Cruz was a very strong candidate who really could win in every way. He demonstrated it very strongly by becoming so successful. He was told when he tried to block Obamacare and shut the government down that was going to kill him politically. Well, it didn't do that.
In fact, he's stronger tonight.
So I really hoped we would have him against Hillary and have a real choice for the first
time
in decades.
Ted Cruz is stronger today than he was 6 months ago. There are a lot of people dancing on the grave and a lot of silly people and silly things, but the really serious analysis is, wait a minute. I mean, you know, of all the Republican candidates who are connected, he's got the most votes. He came out on top. I mean, Trump is an outsider completely, not just outside of Washington. He's completely an outsider to this kind of thing, into Republican politics. And I think Cruz looks strong. I think he looks as strong as Reagan did in 76 when it comes within the party.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. Since we talked about space so much, we got about three and a half minutes or so, 4 minutes, three and a half. space policy? I mean, Trump is a private business guy. Is he going to try to be another grandiose deal for NASA to build a Trump Tower on the moon? Or is he the kind of guy that's going to say, you know, y'all are wasting a hell of a lot of money. Let's go let Elon Musk and everybody else and Branson and Bezos and everybody else do it. What do you
think? I have a post on Behind the Black on this because there was one writer that looked at what all three candidates have said about space, Sanders, Clinton, and Trump. And all three of them actually have been pretty clear. They mouth platitudes towards NASA, but at the same time, they all three say we don't have the money right now for a big program. The Democrats have different reasons for doing it. They want to spend lots more money on liberal social programs, but they don't want to spend it on space. Trump said he doesn't want to spend a lot of money on a gigantic program. We can't afford it right now. But he did say that he thinks NASA and the government should partner with private commercial space. It's a more effective way to do it. So at least we have – now, I don't trust what they say on the campaign very much, but at least what we have from Trump is an indication that he at least sees the value of a private partnership with the government, letting private enterprise do the job. Now, of course, a private partnership with government could also be crony capitalism with big money going to big you know, the
right.
big
Right, you got to be very careful.
So I don't
with that
know
kind
what
of thing.
Will happen, but the hint is that at least he has a recognition of that. We'll have to find out.
Bob, I really do appreciate you taking the extra time with us today, more than the
My
hour
pleasure.
Planned, and I encourage everyone to read BehindTheBlack.com. I read it every evening on my Kindle when I lie down for the night, because it usually takes two or three more hours before I can ever go to sleep. And I do want to say, and not because you were kidding me about it, I really highly recommend your book, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8, folks. It is just fabulous. It's in the ebook. Version. You can go to BehindTheBlack.com, click and link on it. And Bob's written quite a few other books, and I've read, I think, almost all of them. They're all excellent. The book on Hubble is just phenomenal, and I think it's the official
history. It is not an official history. I don't work for NASA. No one approved it. I wrote what I thought was appropriate, and it is a good history. There's no question.
Well, it is. Let me change the word. It is the definitive history.
Yeah. Meet up with other Pratt on Texas listeners on Facebook. Username Pratt on Texas.